Chris, you've said that failed politicians make the best diarists. Why should that be?
Well, I think they've got less to justify. I mean, it's a light-hearted comment. I wouldn't want to make too much of it. But if you look at the people who've been, whose diaries have been most successful, they've been people who occupied the lower or at the very most middle ranks. Chip Shannon in the 1930s, a Conservative MP, who never rose higher than Parliamentary Private Secretary to the Deputy Foreign Minister. And yet, well, what he did, of course, he married into the Guinness family and entertained on an awesome scale. The King comes to dinner in the middle of the abdication crisis. I can't match that, of course. And then Alan Clark really was from the lower reaches, although he probably would deny it. He didn't occupy one of the top posts in government. And the other example is Jock Colville, who was private secretary to Churchill, not a politician. He wrote a very good diary, which was published, I don't know, 20 years ago. But none of those people, all among the most successful diarists, occupied top jobs.
Why did you call it A View from the Foothills?
Well, it brings us back to the earlier point, namely that it is from the foothills. It's not from the Olympian Heights. There will be plenty, no shortage of memoirs from those who have occupied the stratosphere. But in a way, and this is true, I think, of Alistair Campbell's diaries, interesting though they are, in the stratosphere, life is moving along at extraordinary speed. And it's very hard to keep up. Also, I think, although this may not apply in Alistair's case, but it will do to the politicians, you tend to spend a lot of time justifying whatever it is you've done. Whereas I think those lower down the pecking order tend to have more time to step back from events a bit and talk in a more dispassionate way about what was going on around them.
You spent 2 years working for John Prescott as an environment minister, and during that time your opinion of him changed. You said at one point that under that volcanic exterior there lurks a decent human being.
Yes, I worked for Prescott for 18 months and it was a kind of white knuckle ride. It was a vast department with about eight ministers, of which Prescott, the Deputy Prime Minister, was at the top. And we'd have ministerial meetings which tended to be a sort of stream of consciousness about whatever had hit him on the way into work this morning. So my first impressions weren't very favourable, but I began to notice after a while that, firstly, he's got very good political antennae. Secondly, he's very loyal to colleagues and a man of his word. And thirdly, on several occasions, let me give you an example. One of the political advisers once circulated some brief on Archie Norman, who was Prescott's opposite number on the Tory side, who was a businessman. And it was all about Archie's financial interests and so forth. Prescott just thrust it aside and said, I'm not having anything to do with that. It demeans politics. So you could see there was a decent streak in him. He was also very successful in screwing money out of the Treasury for transport. I think he got more out of it than any of his predecessors.
You weren't in the stratosphere. You describe yourself as the undersecretary for folding deck chairs. But nevertheless, you were quite important as a minister. And one of the things that you get quite stressed about in reading these diary entries is that when you're called upon to talk about things about which you know next to nothing, which does sound a very stressful situation to be in.
Yeah, I had three ministerial posts. The third one, which was as the Africa Minister in the Foreign Office, was wonderful. I was a round peg in a round hole. But as I said, 18 months in the environment, in the vast Department of Environment, Transport and the Regions, tended to be a cascade of all the many things that one's superiors didn't wish to do. So, for example, an invitation when I'd been there a few weeks was passed down to me from Nick Rainsford's office, and it still had the private secretary's note appended to it, and it said, this is very low priority. I suggest we pass it to Mr. Mullin. So I wrote no on it in large letters and waited to see what would happen. And as I anticipated, within minutes, someone was in my office explaining why it was really of the highest priority. And there was a constant stream of invitations to address conferences, often of experts, 200 people about coastal erosion. The speech would be thrust into your hand on the morning of the event. Often it would be full of impenetrable jargon, which I did my best to delete. And then the terrible moment after you delivered it would come when the chairman would say, and the minister has time to answer a few questions. Well, it could get a bit scary.
you have a lot of disdain for New Labour jargon, and you weren't really a creature of New Labour, and yet, and you were quite, also before you were minister, you were quite happy on the Home Affairs Select Committee, of which you were chairman, an influential post. How did Tony Blair sweet talk you into becoming a minister twice?
Well, I'd been chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee for a couple of years, and I'd been on the committee for 7 years. So I figured it was time for a change. I initially turned down the job because I was under no illusions that it was at the bottom of a very large pile. So I initially turned it down, and then he rang back and said, don't worry, it's only for a few months and I'll find you something more suitable in the Foreign Office or the Home Office. Well, a few months turned out to be 18 months. Then I was moved to Clare Short's department, much smaller, much happier department, international development. That was, in a way, I was around peg in a round hole. The only problem there was that Clare, wonderful woman though she was, is, didn't need a deputy. She didn't delegate anything at all. And therefore, after 5 months, I concluded that it would be better returning to the ranks. So come the 2001 general election, I indicated that I'd prefer to go back to the ranks. And then I had another stroke of good fortune. I got back the two jobs that I'd previously had as chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee and as one of the elected members of the Parliamentary Committee, which meets the Prime Minister every Wednesday, a degree of access that no junior minister has.
You refer to Tony Blair throughout the book as the man. I'm curious to know, is that a term that just you had for him, or was that shared by your colleagues?
Well, I think after I'd been using it for a few months, several of my colleagues started using it as well. It was a very, as has often been remarked upon, he was very definitely in charge, and it was a very Prime Minister-centred government, and he was the man, and that's how I referred to him. And as I say, it caught on after a while.
Although you weren't a supporter of all of Tony Blair's works, you clearly have a lot of admiration for Tony Blair.
Yes, I do. Yes, I thought he was a very capable, inspirational, far-sighted leader. And I thought he achieved a lot during the 10 years that he was Prime Minister. But he made one huge mistake, in my view, and that is that he linked us umbilically to the worst American president of my lifetime, with consequences that we all know about.
Do you think that Tony Blair will be remembered more kindly by history than he is regarded now?
It's hard to say how Tony Blair will be remembered. I think one thing that you can never take away from him is the effort he put into achieving peace in Northern Ireland. You have to remember that had been an intractable problem for generations, and it was, I know there's been a bit of difficulty recently, but it was by and large sorted on his watch, and he personally put an enormous effort into that. Also, if I look at the lives of my constituents, particularly the poorer ones, many of them benefited considerably from the 10 years of government that he led. Also, he has in him, and I don't suppose many people would acknowledge this, but I noticed it, a definite streak of idealism. Why else would he have worked so hard to push Africa up the international agenda? There were no votes in doing that, and yet he made it one of the priorities for his dealings at G7 or G8 summits, and also for the policy of his government.
What do you felt that you achieved during the period? Because you lament over and over again that you're just not doing anything useful, which you don't describe yourself as an ambitious politician, but you certainly wanted to be doing something useful. But what do you think your achievements were during this time?
Well, in the 18 months that I spent at Environment, there's very few useful things I can point to. In the 4 years I spent as chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee, there were all sorts of things in some of the reports and investigations we did that were implemented on policy towards drugs, on police complaints and discipline, transparency for Freemasons in certain parts of public life, and as Africa Minister too. Very hard to quantify achievements in foreign policy, but we were signed up to a policy which I wholly agreed. And I think the British international development policy is among the most effective in the world.
You're standing down at the next election, Chris. Why is that?
Well, I thought it better to go while people were still asking me why rather than when. And I also feel I've outlived my usefulness. When there are people in the cabinet who are 20 years younger than you, I think you've got to notice that the caravan's moved on fairly decisively. Yes, I shall miss it, though. I don't pretend otherwise. I mean, it is a way of life, not just a job. And you don't always appreciate what you've got until you've lost it. So I'm sure you've probably got another year to go. But I am a bit nervous as I approach the beckoning abyss.
Chris Mullin, many thanks for talking to us.